Dystopia is actually a very funny word if you think about it. And not funny in the sense of, how come totalitarian governments are always defeated by attractive young people? But funny because you know what it means immediately when you hear the word. But the more you think about it, the more the definitions start to blur. What is dystopia anyway? The opposite of utopia? Considering that utopias don't exist, I suppose that's our society, right? How more opposite can you be to fiction than reality? So deep, bro. Different dictionary explanations define dystopia as an imagined state or society with great suffering and injustice. But injustice, great suffering, and people living in wretched, dehumanized conditions is all too common in our world and getting worse since 2020. Because a global pandemic is exactly the kind of backstory plot point used to explain the rise of the dystopian system, isn't it? The year was 2020, and the boomers forced us to stay inside all day to look at nothing but cat videos and game with my homies on Discord. And it was then that I fell into the most sinister trap ever devised. The love triangle. My point is that dystopian fiction is getting eerily close to home, and there are several unique flavors to choose from. Four to be exact. The bleak totalitarian state, cyberpunk megacities, the theocratic society, and the neo-feudal future. Where do we go from here?
Power is tearing human minds apart and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. We control life at all levels. We create human nature. Men are infinitely malleable.
Can there be any doubt that behind my arrest, a vast organization is at work? An establishment which contains a retinue of civil servants, officers, police, and others, perhaps even hangmen.
Corps have long controlled our lives, taken lots. And now they're after our souls. I've declared war not because capitalism's a thorn in my side or out of nostalgia for an America gone by. This war's a people's war against a system that spiraled out of our control. It's a war against the fucking forces of entropy.
From the moment I understood the weakness of my flesh, it disgusted me. I aspired to the purity of the blessed machine.
You have to look at the bigger picture. It's for the greater good.
For the greater good.
All will be brought to the greater good.
Burn the heretic! Kill the mutants!
Purge the unclean!
We fight! We compete! Evolution is continuous!
We will fight on! We shall struggle, compete, plunder, and dominate! And in the end, the future shall be ours!
Long live the fighters!
With your birth comes a solemn vow. You will have nothing. Your privilege is the dirt. Your freedom will be the wars you wage. Your birthright, the losses you suffer. Your entitlement, the pain you endure. In the darkness, only ambition will guide you.
Power is not a means, it is an end.
What's hilarious is that everyone has an inner 12-year-old in their soul that secretly wants to live in at least two of these. And who can blame them? Cyborg cowboys and space knights are so good! Tell me in the comments which of the four types of dystopia you choose to live in if you had to. I'm seriously curious, by the way, because I'm personally torn. Like Katniss Everdeen having to choose between a psycho and a simp. Do you want the totalitarian bureaucracy that watches your every move and gets you in trouble for wrongthink? How about an emerging neo-medieval world order with powerful private military companies? What about all the tech bros who have a tizzy for making cyberpunk a reality? With all new chips in our brains, crazy AI, and virtual reality. You know, so we can pay for our own enslavement in the maw of the digital leviathan? Even though the YA dystopian phase has long died out by now in a publishing industry that has moved on to... I don't know what young people are reading these days.
Smut.
You won't ever find a guy like...
your mouth in a second. I promise you're not gonna yell for help.
Listen to me.
Dystopia, as a genre, has been recapturing the public imagination, as we see with the Hunger Games prequel and the Uglies adaptation on Netflix. I suppose it's because the misuse of tech is a big part of dystopia, and we recently have new tech that emerged just in time to be misused and blur the line of what it means to be human. I love how generated AI images and audio are making liberal art types suddenly rage against progress and finally see the need to preserve the old ways. And meanwhile, traditionalists be like, "Welcome to la résistance, mon ami! Here we have only two genders." That's the next YA dystopian novel right there. And while the threat of a theocratic dystopia is just a political talking point in the West, it's not so in other parts of the world. While Handmaid's Tale cosplay may be silly LARPing in Washington protests, it's eerily close to reality in Iran, and more recently Afghanistan, as well as spreading around the world in countries you wouldn't expect, like the Maldives. But thankfully, true dystopias are, for now at least, only a literary hypothetical used to explore just how bad things can get for humanity. Though it's also a fine place to find teen love, apparently. But the worst part about dystopian storytelling is that, although it's highly necessary as a social defense mechanism to think of how bad things can get and then avoid it, you never know if your book devising a clever new way to subjugate humanity will unintentionally give ideas to some rich and powerful dude somewhere in the world who will go, "Write that down! Write that down!" Like Mark Zuckerberg, literally trying to bring the metaverse concept from a cyberpunk dystopian novel called Snow Crash into reality and renaming his entire company after it. Or like Mr. Beast watching Squid Game, where a billionaire toys with people's hopes by making them struggle with each other for money, so he can wave bizarre entertainment content and going all, "How about that? But real!" But I get it, we all have a dark side to us, which is what makes dystopia a disturbing possibility. But jokes aside, dystopia as a concept is actually 1,000 times more sinister than just being about the dark side of humanity or simple things like injustice, authoritarianism, and terrible living conditions. These things are also present in other genres, which are not to be considered dystopian. Like the post-apocalypse genre. There can be overlaps, to be sure, but not necessarily. Mad Max Fury Road is not dystopian, for instance, because although the post-apocalyptic society of Immortan Joe is brutal and horrific, it's unfortunately a very human horror present throughout history. He's just a violent warlord with a harem, and these guys are a dime a dozen in the written record. Heck, most of us are direct descendants of dudes like that. Dystopia at its core is about dehumanization, where the system or social structure is redesigning and disfiguring what it means to be human, whether physically, like in Cyberpunk, with the man and machine dichotomy, or just psychologically, like in Orwell's 1984, or The Hunger Games. The post-apocalyptic genre is about modernity lost. The end of the modern era, typically due to a disaster where human society reverts back to pre-modern social models. It usually reflects on the positive advances of modernity that shouldn't be taken for granted. The post-apocalyptic genre asks the question, wouldn't it be horrible if we lost modern society with all its benefits? Meanwhile, dystopia is about modernity gone wrong. How the systems and values of the modern era can progress horribly to the point where it might not even be a human society anymore. Maybe it becomes a hive mind, a purely impersonal system, or a society with genetic engineering that creates a new biological race with dubious humanity. It asks the question, isn't modern society, with all its demands, actually pretty horrible? On second thought, I think I'm being too hasty in my conclusions. The post-apocalyptic genre does also explore the modern era going wrong, but by exploring how the modern era can destroy itself, usually by nuclear war, like Mad Max or Fallout, or by artificial intelligence and robotics causing the downfall of humanity, where modernism in its worship of change and the cancerous growth of progress for its own sake leads to the inevitable result of humans replacing themselves with machines, which then sets humanity back. Like Horizon Forbidden West or AI Limit, that has a similar theme, but where the art, design, and the main female protagonist is actually nice to look at. By the way, you can play AI Limit on Steam in the link in the description that I'll provide, and give it a shot if you want. This is not a paid promotion, not a sponsorship. The developers are actually a small studio and a fan of my channel, so I decided to give them a shout out. If we want the gaming industry to improve from the crap we see right now, then giving a chance to new players on the block is the way to go. These types of AI-driven post-apocalypse stories put modern technology in a different context, often mythologizing it, where the remnants of technology are seen through a mystical and pre-modern lens. Almost suggesting that the lack of respect for the power of technology is what led to the self-destruction of the modern world. While in dystopia, modernity persists, but it goes wrong, revealing the worst aspects of itself. The post-apocalyptic genre often deals with the return of slavery and harems, which are dehumanizing social systems, yes, but it's a limited form of dehumanization, because it simply treats humans as animals, a breeding mare, or beasts of burden. Treating each other like this is unfortunately quite historically human, and it mostly dehumanizes the lower classes, while the upper classes are still kept as human, even if horrible human beings. But the dystopian genre is about the dehumanization of everyone, including the elites, who often lose their humanity trying to play God. The dystopian genre served as a response to the utopian literature that emerged in the beginning of the modern era. These were stories about travelers coming across strange alternative societies that were undeniably better than ours in many ways. Most notable was the book now named Utopia, though the original title was some word count buster like a Japanese isekai light novel. Ironically, many scholars agree that St. Thomas More's novel was a critique of the emerging modern and mercantile society of his day, and was a defense of simpler and more ascetic medieval social values. However, although Utopia in the book is displayed in a positive light, it was still mostly satire, because the character describing Utopia was called Raphael Hiflodei. His last name literally means talker of nonsense in Greek. Also, the full title alone is obviously comedic. I mean, just look at that thing. It's ridiculous. Not to mention that Utopia is a society that has customs that goes against Catholic moral teaching. And Thomas More became a Catholic saint because he chose to die rather than live in a society with customs against Catholic teaching. In all likelihood, Utopia was a book reflecting on social alternatives to the money-hungry empires that European societies were becoming. But the society described in Utopia was not meant to be an idealized, perfect society for humanity to strive for. Again, it was satire, which is ironic because Utopia spawned the utopian socialist movement, and socialists often accuse everyone else of not having media literacy, when to this day, socialists take Utopia at face value. A book closer to what we actually think of as utopian fiction was Francis Bacon's work titled New Atlantis, which was published a century later in 1627, and envisioned a scientifically advanced society run by priest scientists who studied in a public academic institution and ran systemic experimentation to develop human knowledge over nature for social improvement. This book was actually meant to be the idealized society that Bacon wanted. And we know that because they were Christians in a scientific theocracy, which is exactly what the Christian who hated atheists and was father of the scientific method would have wanted. And then there was Vril, The Power of the Coming Race, published in 1871, written by Edward Bulwer Lytton, about a civilization of superhumans living underground who lived peaceful, prosperous lives because they mastered the power of Vril, which is basically like mana in fantasy RPGs. This book was immensely popular in its day and is arguably the source of the Force in Star Wars, or the Psykers in Warhammer 40k. The Vril is the power that these people got through eugenics. But here we see the dark side of Utopia because although the Vrilya, as they're called, are undeniably better and even more moral than us, surface dwellers in many ways, eventually they'll rise to the surface and exterminate the lesser races. That's us, by the way! And that's portrayed as inevitable because we're shown as even more genocidal than they are. Because the protagonist fantasizes about taking over the Vrilya as their dictator and manipulating them into conquering the world. So them as the utopia emerging from underground to destroy us all is some terrifying symbolism. Every utopian society has a dystopian underbelly because the imagination of one man is not powerful enough to contain all the necessities of the human spirit, because the humans are flawed. The Star Trek Federation would be a good time for many, but it'd be an existential hellhole for the guy like me. Likewise, the Terran Federation of the book, Starship Troopers, not the movie, would be a good time for many, but a hellscape for others, and both were designed to be idealized societies, even if not exactly perfect. What does it mean to be human? Well, humans have a physical aspect, two legs, two arms, skin and bones, but also an abstract aspect. We have intellect, free will, and inherent human dignity. We need food, but we also need psychological and spiritual nourishment. Dystopia is a society that disfigures human beings on a systemic level, and this entire genre was born as the rationalistic, economic, and scientific aspects of the modern era opened up new horizons of dehumanization. Dystopias often reflect on how this relates to class systems, especially in the YA variety like Hunger Games, Divergent, and Red Rising. Say what you want about the young adult genre, but they get class dynamics better than the common political discourse. This is because our modern understanding of class overly emphasizes economic status. You know, middle class, lower class, upper class, etc. Or it's in the framework of property owners and those who don't own property but sell their labor. The conversation is generally influenced by theories from Adam Smith, Karl Marx, Max Weber, and others. But what many forget is that in pre-modern times, class was more associated with social function, i.e. what your role in society was. You had the warrior class, the merchant class, artisans and manual laborers, peasants, the priest class, and in places like China, the Mandarin scholar bureaucratic overlord class. Your role in society was much more important than economic status. In China, for instance, the classes were called the four occupations, the scholar, farmer, craftsman, and merchant classes. In Japan, it was the shinokosho, but with the difference of the formal warrior class of the samurai being the ruling class, and not the scholar bureaucrats. The emperor was a figurehead, and the daimyo were basically samurai on steroids. In the Hindu class system, the ruling class was the priest class, called the Brahmin, and the Kshatriya warrior class ruled in second place, directly under them. In Mesoamerica, it was a similar structure, with the nobles being the warrior class under a priest class, with the emperor as high priest. Different societies had a similar logic to how they worked, but what changed was what social class was at the top and who was at the bottom, with merchants getting socially shafted in China and Japan, while it was the peasant farmers that got shafted in India. Or technically it was the untouchables, the Dalit class, but weren't even part of the caste system. In medieval Europe, it was slightly unique, where the clergy and the royals often shared power, keeping each other in check. Royals and nobles were landowners, sure, but that came with a social function they had to fulfill, namely protect the people living in their lands. They were defined by their warrior purpose, which is why their rituals involve weapons.
Receive these spurs, symbols of military honor and chivalry, that you may be a brave advocate for those in need.
But what's crucial is that economic power wasn't as important as it became in the modern era. The merchant class were often richer than the warrior nobles, but what were they going to do when the samurai lopped their heads off for not bowing properly? In Europe, money wasn't all that powerful either. The French kings owed money to both the Jews and the Templars, but instead of paying them back, they just marched in with their bigger army and took the property and kicked both the Jews and the Templars out. Like some dude on the internet said, "If I have gold, I'll use it to buy iron. Then I'll use the iron to beat your ass, and now I have both gold and iron." That's the warrior class logic for you. The different social classes in history often have their own internal culture and values. And the values that society holds depends on which class has become the ruling class. There's a reason why we don't like dueling or hunting and falconry anymore. Even in the Middle Ages and early modern period, the priests and the bureaucrats thought that was stupid. When the warrior class lost power, that became the prevailing opinion. Now everybody thinks it's stupid. But does everything I'm saying sound familiar? I'm not going on a tangent for no reason. I got into social class structures because dystopian stories are literally defined by it. It's the nature of whatever class system the author makes up that makes it so dystopian. The most famous one is the genetically engineered class system in A Brave New World, where the alphas and the betas and gammas, etc. are genetically manufactured with different levels of intelligence to fulfill different social roles. This looks like some YA novel cringe if it was written by a red pill bro, or one of those ladies into werewolf smut, doesn't it? But YA dystopias were just imitating the masters. In George Orwell's 1984, you also have a famous class system modeled after the socialist bureaucracy of the Soviets. You can see that dystopian class systems are mostly defined by social role in the power structure as opposed to economic class, right? Kind of like how our ancestors saw it. While The Hunger Games is a mix of an economic class system with a social role class system. The oppressive capital is a totalitarian government ruled by technocratic bureaucrats, and the different districts are made up of poor laborers, craftsmen, and District 2 is where the warrior class live. Later dystopian book series developed this class system idea further. The Divergent series might be trash, but the class dynamics in it are kind of interesting, with the erudite as the technocratic bureaucrats, the dauntless as the warrior class, abnegation as a kind of monastic ascetic priest class, amity as the hippie class. But this culminated with the Red Rising books by Pierce Brown. I like that series. Imagine Percy Jackson and the Hunger Games had a kid who became an edgy political science student in Dune University and played way too much Warhammer 40k with his buddies. That's the perfect description of this series. Even though naming their class system The Society was a little silly, but typical YA nonsense. But Red Rising did feel like the genre was graduating, moving on from the typical teen whining of the genre. "It's just so hard being a teenager in a first world country. You need to decide what you want for college and obsess over dating and make your entire personality revolve around a single and arbitrary social issue." There's a reason why this genre produced mostly lowbrow and predatory books preying on young people's insecurities and power fantasies. There was one about abortion, another about plastic surgery, beauty standards. That Netflix film is gonna suck. Most YA dystopian books were complete garbage, especially mine. That's right, I wrote a crappy YA novel 10 years ago that I published with a Quebecois Canadian company. And no, I'm not telling you the title, because I'm embarrassed about it. There's a typo in every paragraph since my French-speaking publisher refused to hire a starving English graduate from Toronto or something as copy editor for my book. In order to what? Fulfill their 1,000-year plan to murder the English language? It was a crappy story anyway. Super edgy and trippy, with barely disguised, perpetually online, esoteric internet politics all over that motherfucker. Where the dystopian overlords are a secret society of Luciferian alchemists experimenting on children to achieve godhood. The older generation literally feeding off the younger generation as the female protagonist is a schizophrenic redhead chick, tripping balls and seeing floating elves while trying not to be liquefied into an immortality serum, and the male protagonist is a university edgelord who gets absolutely crushed by the tyrants in a tragic but hopeful ending to his character because he challenged the academic authorities. The sequel was going to get even crazier, but that ain't gonna happen. Just imagine a cringe 21-year-old internet monarchist tradcath writing a YA dystopian novel and you have a pretty good idea of what that book is like. I was trying to reflect on the flaws of a Faustian technocratic class of experts to show how being knowledgeable doesn't mean anything if they use their knowledge for egomaniacal reasons. Morality is more important for politics than expertise. But anyway, the reason why we think of social class in economic terms these days is because the merchant class took over in the modern era from the 15th century to the 19th century, and wealth is their particular means to power. But they were then supplanted by the managerial bureaucratic class in the 20th century, which is why we're slowly starting to think in class defined by social role again. Because people in positions of power within bureaucracies are often more powerful than mere wealthy capitalists.
And that's where, because my tribe is what the kids call PMC, professional management class. Okay? For that class, the status quo is pretty good.
He's in, boys! He did it! He said it!
As James Burnham explained in his book, The Managerial Revolution, the modern era values of the Enlightenment was just the merchant and bureaucratic classes taking over from the priest and warrior classes that ruled over most pre-modern societies. When you look at liberalism, capitalism, Rousseau's ideas, or socialism, all these ideologies are not really great feats of rational thinking and higher enlightened morality. It's just the rationalizing for the merchant and bureaucratic class interests. It's why supposedly great thinkers like Mandeville and Adam Smith argue that selfishness is a good thing, don't you know? Of course, merchants would love that idea. While Hegel and Rousseau think everything would be much better if the state institutions ran everything. Of course, bureaucratic types love those guys. They tried getting rid of the traditional social classes in the Enlightenment era and the 20th century, but it did not work. But at least we got this brand new literary genre called dystopia instead. Society will never be perfect, but it can avoid pathological dysfunction if the social classes are in harmony, and the class system doesn't have to be rigid and hereditary. The USA, despite all its faults, will avoid entering dystopia as long as the social classes are in harmony. America has a warrior class with the veterans, a merchant class with the corporate types, a technocratic bureaucratic class with the civil servants and government experts and corporate HR harpies, a priest class with the ideological academics, but it's a class system that allows personal choice and meritocracy. When there's no nepotism, the creeping social dysfunction that many Americans are feeling happens when one of the social classes gets too powerful and tips the balance against the others. Which finally brings me to the four types of dystopia. Each of the four kinds of dystopian fiction are actually one of these social classes getting all the power as the ruling class. The Orwellian state is about bureaucrats. Cyberpunk is about the merchants. Theocratic authoritarianism is about the priest class. And neo-feudalist future societies are about the return of the warrior ruling class. Proof that the different flavors of dystopia are based on the different ruling classes is the Orwellian dystopia versus cyberpunk. Both are surveillance techno-dystopias, but they're very much distinct from each other, based entirely on who runs the show, which then determines how they operate. One is obsessed with control, and other is obsessed with profit. Not entirely the same, because you can still profit from chaos, which is why cyberpunk societies are not exactly totalitarian. When talking about the four types of dystopia, I'll go by the order of the most dystopian to the least dystopian type, and I'll explain why in each segment. And by most dystopian, I mean which one is the most dehumanizing, where the human condition is dissolved the most by the system. But keep in mind that dehumanizing doesn't necessarily mean brutal and horrific. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World is more dystopian than the Imperium in Dune, for example. But the latter is a lot more brutal, frightening, and less pleasant to the average person, but it still preserves the human condition, family, childhood, spirituality, artistic pursuits, community, etc. While Brave New World is way more pleasant, but as a society of factory-produced engineered humans biologically and psychologically conditioned to have an aversion to family, art, spirituality, and many other essential things to the human experience. Again, dystopia is not just about normal oppression, it's about oppressing the humanity out of civilization. By the way, I'll leave the links to the books I mentioned on Amazon in the description. Moving on. Type 1. Tyranny without a tyrant. The first type is the bureaucratic ruling class type of dystopia, and it's clearly the most dehumanizing since it's what created the entire dystopian genre in the first place. The novel We by Yevgeny Zamyatin is actually the first dystopian novel ever written, done so by a Soviet author observing up close what the communists were doing. George Orwell's 1984 is actually directly inspired by that novel. We by Zamyatin created the template of the dehumanizing system so obsessed with efficiency, material productivity, and control that the system redesigns human beings through lobotomy to make us biological robots easier to control. George Orwell actually rips off that exact same plot, but develops psychological manipulation of the mind through language instead of physical manipulation of the brain through surgery. 1984 is actually more impactful than We because it reveals more subtle ways for individuals to lose their humanity. The bureaucratic managerial class is the most dystopian of the four ruling classes because the main aspect of management is control. So when it becomes pathological, it's the one that most tries and succeeds to change, alter and warp the human condition through excessive manipulation. It leads to the creation of an all-encompassing system of control, a labyrinth of laws where humanity gets lost in, like what Hannah Arendt says. In a fully developed bureaucracy, there is nothing left with whom one can argue, to whom one can present grievances, on whom the pressures of power can be exerted. Bureaucracy is the form of government in which everybody is deprived of political freedom, the power to act. For the rule by nobody is not no rule, and where all are equally powerless, we have a tyranny without a tyrant. End quote. Which is what we see in Kafka's famous dystopian books. You can imagine this gets worse when you apply science, right? That's what technocracy is. It's the merging of science in service of the bureaucracy. You know, scientific management. And it's a nightmare. Real-world methods of scientific management, like Taylorism and Fordism, born from American factories, are literally mentioned in both We and the Brave New World novels, as the ruling ideology of the technocratic overlords. It was the fear of applying the cold calculating system of the bureaucracy to every aspect of human life, since control naturally wants to extend itself. Like Oscar Wilde put it, the bureaucracy is expanding to meet the needs of the expanding bureaucracy. And the worst part about all of this is that it's extremely dystopian whether the all-consuming bureaucracy is competent, like in 1984, where they effectively crush rebellion, or whether they're incompetent, like in the movie Brazil, where even if you just mind your own business, some intern can accidentally ruin your life by classifying you as a rebel by accident. The existence of the all-consuming bureaucracy itself is the problem. It's not a matter of being well-run or not. Now, I don't want to come across as a pure bureaucracy hater. I'm just focusing on the negatives because this video is about dystopia. But the bureaucratic class has achieved many wonderful things in history, like the eradication of smallpox. It's not a coincidence that it was a Soviet technocrat called Viktor Zhdanov who led the initial plan. The eradication of smallpox was a massive international effort where the global bureaucracy collaborated with the local bureaucracies to eliminate one of the deadliest diseases known to man. It's truly a triumphant episode in our history, and it's events like this that make many academics believe that the bureaucratic technocratic management will lead to utopia, and we just need to give them authority to do it. The COVID pandemic fiasco, however, is proof that we shouldn't. They really fumbled the ball with that one, and revealed their dystopian side to the whole world. In any case, this is the most dystopian of the four types because it turns everyone into a cog or statistic, even those of the ruling class.
Here we are, your very own number.
Congratulations, DZ-stroke-015. Welcome to the team.
Wokeism, socialism, communism, call it what you like, and other types of ideology function mostly to justify expanding the power of the bureaucratic class. Why are academics and government officials obsessed over transgender stuff? Simple, because if the individual cannot be trusted to define what a woman is by simple and clear physical observations, like a working vajayjay, but needs a douchebag with a college degree in bullshitology, then the bureaucracy successfully mind-fudged you into justifying more power for itself. Not even something as basic as knowing what a woman is can be left up to the individual. Bureaucratic class interests promotes relativism of truth, because then the raw state power that they control, or some expert of the state, can determine what's true at a given moment according to the interests of the bureaucracy. That's literally what you see in 1984. The relativistic totalitarianism of INSOC, where only the state is absolute. That's why they constantly rewrite history and contradict themselves in doublethink, with slogans like peace is war, ignorance is strength, etc. In the real world, real intellectuals aren't much better. Like Karl Popper, who literally said, we must be intolerant against those who practice intolerance, and then acted like that mind fudge he just said is something deep. The fascist dystopia, as we see in V for Vendetta, and the German Workers' Party in Philip K. Dick's Man in the High Castle, also falls into this type of dystopia. Even though many mistakenly think fascism is a warrior class dystopia type, it definitely is run by the bureaucratic class. It just uses nationalism to justify the totalitarian bureaucracy, where you need your Aryan papers and such. Fascism is an example of the banality of evil, but this ominous aspect comes directly from the uncaring bureaucracy, the middle manager just following orders. Fascism and communism look so similar because both governments have the same combination of ruling classes, namely bureaucrats with an ideological priest class, blasting constant propaganda to justify totalitarian control of the party. That's why they basically behave the same, even if both have opposite doctrines where fascism preaches hierarchy and communism preaches equality. In socialism, it's the same thing, where equality is used to justify abolishing property rights and having government officials hoard all the wealth for themselves. It's why the short story called Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut is one of my favorite dystopian stories ever, because it's about the government using equality to justify dystopian control that impedes the yearnings of the human soul for beauty and excellence.
The strong wore weights to make them weaker. The intelligent wore earpieces that kept them from taking unfair advantage of their brains. It was the golden age of equality.
Equality is a useful dystopian value because equality doesn't exist and never will.
All men are not created equal.
But it sounds nice. So it's the absolute best excuse to justify increasing power to the system that's always going, give us more power, and then we'll finally bring equality, I promise. If you're a socialist, you need to reflect on why your ideology was the one to literally inspire the dystopian genre into existence. With the benefactor in We and INGSOC, which stands for English Socialism, in 1984. I'm not trying to be a dick, I'm just making a friendly point. But don't worry, capitalists are douchebags too, and are the second most dystopian of the four types. Which brings me to the merchant class dystopia. Type 2. The Almighty Dollar. Like I said before, cyberpunk being defined by profit makes it less obsessed with control, but the dehumanizing effect comes from turning humans into products. It's where the androids and cyborgs come in. Science and technology is used for the creation of things to be bought and sold. The cyborg stuff is what happens when you apply that to the human form. But the elites are also dehumanized by becoming a brand. It's why merchant class dystopias have more of a focus on the founding family's names or the names of individuals who turn themselves into the brands of mega corporations, like the Arasaka and Tyrell corporations from Edge Runners 2077 and Blade Runner, respectively. Or they sell themselves as the visionary behind whatever product they're selling, like Andrew Ryan from Bioshock, selling you a one-way ticket to Enrighty in Hell! We also see this in the real world with Trump and Elon Musk and Mr. Beast, etc. Merchant class rule turns the rulers into a brand. That's also dehumanizing. That's the main characteristic of a dystopia. It's where one pathological system consumes everything. In merchant class dystopias, the effect is particularly insidious because even when you try to escape it, you feed the beast. It's where the punk and cyberpunk comes in. Even the aesthetic of the cool rebel fighting the system becomes a brand and a product. It's why cyberpunk is often such an angry genre. The name Cyberpunk first originated from a short story of that name, which later became the title of this whole thing, because it's fitting. Precisely because it's an anti-capitalist genre filled with cool games, movies, books, toys, clothes, and comics that you can buy right now and have Amazon shipped it to you on one of those retarded Zeppelin drones for just $9.99, which if you flip it upside down, it becomes $666. You're still feeding the beast? The reason for this is because the market is the summation of human interaction. So even by fighting against it or running away from it, you interact with the system. Where are you going to buy weapons to fight the corpos, bro? Where are you going to buy the ticket for a rocket ship to leave the Earth and escape them? It's why the cyberpunk genre is filled with advertising for you to leave and go to outer space. You might be less beholden to your corporate overlords in the frontier colony worlds and more free and independent from their influence, but they don't care because they can monetize your desire for independence and escape. We saw this in real history, where the USA was literally created by private royal charter companies making money off the settlers who wanted freedom. And this private corporate origin in the DNA of America is why The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins is so unique, because it's a bureaucratic class-type dystopia that operates on merchant-class consumer logic. Since it's a technocracy in the United States, the Americana of it all makes the government of Panem still think in terms of branding, entertainment, show business, etc., even though the mode of production that they have doesn't really require this, which is why The Hunger Games is this weird middle-of-the-road dystopia reminiscent to the American elites now, since the American bureaucracy has been gaining more and more power while still having to pay lip service to the American market culture. The true merchant class dystopia is way more abstract and devious than the bureaucratic dystopian systems in many ways, but it's still less dehumanizing on its own because it depends on your autonomy as a consumer and it tries to profit off of human needs for family, identity, or even spirituality, like the virtual Mercer cult in Philip K. Dick's Blade Runner novel, though it has a dumber name. It just ironically cheapens the human experience by putting a price tag on what should be priceless, but it doesn't outright remove it in the name of control like the previous type of dystopia. However, cyberpunk might end up being its own worst enemy, because as it tries to maximize profit and make humans into products, it ends up turning the human into a machine. But machines don't need capitalism or merchants, they just need efficient management. For merchants, everything is for sale, even their long-term interests. It's how you had American capitalists being paid by the Soviets to help industrialize Russia, who wanted to compete with them. This isn't a class of people who think long-term. For example, once you automate everything, you remove the need for the active human consumer, with his monetizable needs and desires. So the cyberpunk dystopia might just be a transition phase into the technocratic managerial dystopia of the previous type. I guess this is one way to get the destruction of capitalism through its own contradictions that Marxists keep promising us. But it doesn't result in a utopia because nothing does. I want to make clear though, despite my criticisms, I'm generally pro-free market. I just don't think the merchant class should rule society, and I don't make the market itself my ideology. Ideologies naturally limit the human experience into one oversimplified narrative of reality, which makes ideologies of all types, whether libertarian or socialist, naturally dystopian. Don't have an ideology, bros. Have a religion instead, although that too can lead to dystopia, as we see in Type 3. It's heresy. The dystopian theocracy run by the priest class. You'll notice as we go down this list that there are less and less examples in fiction of each dystopia I talk about, precisely because each ruling class is less and less dystopian the closer we get to pre-modern values. Since dystopia is a phenomenon of modernity, and priests and warriors are more of a pre-modern ruling class, but they can also exist in a modern context and be quite dystopian. And do you know what the first type of human government was? It was theocracy. In ancient Sumer, theocracy is the most organic type of government to the human condition, and that's because religion is uniquely human. The animals of prehistory are not religious, and the machines of modernity are also not religious. So a theocratic government naturally preserves an essential human aspect by preserving religion. However, it doesn't always, because a priest class can preach an atheist doctrine as well. I'm using theocracy as a catch-all term for when the priest class rules, but it doesn't actually have to be religious, because the priest class is defined by preaching and enforcing a doctrine. Their role is convincing or forcing everyone to think the same for social cohesion and a common goal. That's the function of the priest class. which means that priests don't have to be literal religious priests. Journalists, academics, social media influencers, all of these are members of the priest class with the role of preaching an idea and influencing public opinion. The Ethereals in the Tal Empire of 40K are a great example of an atheist priest class dystopia. The 30K Imperium of Warhammer was also basically an atheist priest class dystopia, preaching an atheist humanist doctrine as the imperial truth. Through imperial iterators, which are basically missionaries preaching the revealed truth of atheist materialism and secular humanism. Mankind must be free of dogma, and if you question that, then we'll send our cosmic crusading space knights to beat your ass. With 40K, all that really happened was they replaced the original atheist doctrine with a theist doctrine. Rule of the priest class can, in fact, be the undeniable least dystopian of the four types, even less dystopian than the warrior class type, if and only if the specific religion or doctrine of the priest class in charge is explicitly pro-human and aimed at preserving humanity. But if the priest class adheres to an anti-human doctrine, then it can be one of the most dystopian settings, like the extremely dehumanizing transhumanist religion of the cult Mechanicus, also in 40K, which worships the machine and its adepts replace their human parts with mechanical ones, because the machine is immortal, which is awkward because to maintain their religion, they must still retain at least some of their human essence. Because of anti-religious propaganda from the bureaucratic class over the centuries that wanted to replace the old ruling priest class, there is this myth that theocracies bring technological stagnation, which is not true. Since, as we see with the Soviet Union, they censor genetic science as bourgeois pseudoscience invented by capitalists. Even though genetic science was discovered by the Catholic monk Gregor Mendel.
面对广大革命群众，你老实交代，你是不是精通各种力学？你曾经在教学中散布宇宙大爆炸的反动理论，这个理论居然假设了时间的起点。你说什么？那起点以前有什么？没错，这就给上帝的存在留下了位置。你是想说，有上帝？
无论有没有，科学的没给出确实的证据。The man who gave us the scientific concept of the Big Bang worked here, of all places, in this Belgian cathedral. Father George Lemaître, born in 1894, may be the most important physicist you've likely never heard of.
BioShock Infinite is therefore an interesting depiction of a theocratic dystopia because it's still a high-tech society that achieved scientific and technological marvels, but is still dystopian, even though it looks heavenly. And the reason for that is because it's an American theocracy, which means that the theocratic ruling class shares power with the industrialist merchant class in the form of Jeremiah Fink. And it's the merchant class that produces the most technological innovation, even in a dystopian setting, as we see with the cyberpunk genre. Theocracies only limit technology and science if they are highly bureaucratic. So the true dehumanizing aspect of theocratic dystopias occur mostly in two ways. The first one is that the doctrine that the priest class preaches dehumanizes large segments of the human population, when they believe that a group of people should be treated as less than human with less dignity, like women being reduced to breeding bags in the Republic of Gilead in The Handmaid's Tale, or racial minorities being reduced to second-class status like in Columbia of BioShock Infinite. But even when they don't have any beliefs that dehumanize entire populations as less than human, and even when they believe in universal human dignity, a priest class dystopia will still naturally dehumanize non-believers and heretics. I believe that the main way to avoid dystopia is to practice humility, and that includes contemplating how your own group of people is capable of dystopia. And as a Catholic, that's what I'll do right now by recommending a movie. Priest from 2011, my absolute favorite depiction of a Catholic dystopia. I'm partly kidding, but also partly serious. It's one of those unintentionally insightful, trashy B-movies that nobody watched. But I did. I watched it. It's my guilty pleasure. I've watched it so many times. Don't get me wrong, it doesn't depict real Catholicism, since they have female priests and priests aren't actual clerics but are genetically modified vampire hunting super soldiers, but I do like its depiction of a highly regimented industrial society built almost like a dark version of a monastery. And I like how the theocracy in this movie is still a technological powerhouse capable of creating celibate super soldiers. Even though I personally believe that the Catholic Church is the best force in human civilization and the single best institution of history, since I wouldn't be Catholic if I didn't think that, it's important to know that any human organization is capable of dystopian disorder, if we're not careful, since we're all sinners after all. This is important to note because utopian fiction does in fact have a strong Catholic origin and influence to it, but it reveals the path of dystopia. A utopian book called City of the Sun by Tommaso Campanella is a gender egalitarian theocratic utopia, so the opposite of The Handmaid's Tale, and it was written by a Catholic author who was a borderline heretic who believed in astrology, but regardless, he reimagined society as basically one massive monastery, seeing that as the most perfect way to organize all of humanity. But of course that wouldn't work. Real monasteries can be amazing and the closest thing to real utopia. I've lived in one myself in Ireland for a bit, but it's a voluntary thing for people that specifically have that life calling. This reveals a key truth to this entire conversation. Dystopia is when one of the social classes falls out of balance and tries to reorder all of society in its image, even people of other natures who would not fit in its vision. And by doing so, they dehumanize, limit, and oppress the people that fall outside that vision. Wouldn't it be great if all of society were a liberal arts college campus? Or wouldn't it be awesome if all of society were like the NASDAQ? No! Just like you wouldn't like it if all of society were militarized. Type 4. The Way of the Sword. Which leads me to the warrior class dystopia. Simply put, this is a dystopia that dehumanizes the weak. But it's the least dystopian of the four types, which is why there's so little examples of warrior class dystopias in fiction. Alien cultures like the Klingons and Mandalorians don't count. Alien warrior cultures are usually just exotic, otherworldly societies inspired by pre-modern civilizations meant for world-building the setting, so the main character can have a badass alien waifu. Like Eric Weston's novels on Amazon, where the protagonist gets a sci-fi harem of beauties who want to have his babies. Apparently it's more wholesome than it sounds, according to a friend of mine, but regardless, the indie author scene on Amazon is getting pretty wild. Anyway, there are only two real examples that I can think of that properly portrays a dystopia run by the warrior class. One that isn't a complete hilarious cartoon like the Terran Empire in Star Trek that I just can't take seriously. The first example is the first Dune novel that just briefly explores it before shifting to the theocratic dystopia in later books. But it's by far the least dystopian of all these stories I mentioned here, because despite all the oppression and brutality, the Dune Imperium is still humanity at its most natural state that it can possibly be in such a far-flung sci-fi future. Managing to preserve humanity for so long makes it almost non-dystopian. It's almost like a hopeful vision in a way, that humanity can survive so long in its mostly natural state. But it's still dystopian because humanity is genetically, psychologically, socially, and chemically manipulated by weird, strange elites that barely qualify as humans. Genetically speaking, the space navigators, the Bene Gesserit, and the noble lords with superpowers are something else. Perhaps a parasitic human subspecies that use their genetic advantages to pretend to be divine and fool the normal humans. It's very eerie when you see it that way. The other series of books that explores a warrior class dystopia is, of course, Red Rising. If Warhammer 40k ripped off the later Dune books with the God Emperor, Red Rising rips off the first book with the noble houses of space demigods vying for control of planets. It follows the same template as the first Dune novel, almost to a T, but explores it even further, developing a setting where space travel in the solar system makes humanity engage in genetic engineering to adapt to other planets, which naturally brings back ideas of inherent hierarchy through valuable lineages, where one genetic faction calls themselves the Golds and genetically engineers themselves into superhumans capable of subjugating everyone else and then enforcing a genetic caste system defined by social roles. Laborers, merchants, bureaucrats, priests, and pleasure slaves are genetically engineered and eugenically bred to fulfill their social purpose. It's the most in-depth exploration of warrior class dystopia that I've read. even if it's limited by some trashy YA shenanigans. A more highbrow series about the warrior class dystopia might be the Draka series by S.M. Sterling that my fellow YouTuber Pharaoh Historian introduced me to in his really good videos, which I recommend, but I haven't read them yet. But what all these books have in common is the warrior class in relation to slavery and eugenics. Things typical of warrior class societies of Rome, Sparta, Japan, and medieval Europe, like lineages, the value of your ancestors, family nobility, and being well-bred, becomes a system of eugenics once you apply them through modernity. The modern era is defined by grand institutions and systematic methods of control. So these books imagine a grand dystopian institution tasked with maintaining genetic strength and intelligence so that the ruling masters remain the best at violence, which is how they maintain their power. This is the difference between a neo-feudal dystopia like Dune and Red Rising, and a neo-feudal post-apocalyptic scenario like the Brotherhood of Steel in Fallout or Mad Max. The latter happens when modern institutions fail, and the neo-feudal warrior class order emerges from the ashes of failed institutions, usually the military, to pick up the pieces. But in a new feudal dystopia, the modern era naturally develops new institutions and technology that suddenly empowers the rise of a powerful warrior class that was previously subjugated by modern technology, like easy to manufacture guns, but not anymore. And this new military tech makes sword fighting relevant again and creates a new genetic class of supermaster beings. Of course, when you think of militarized eugenics and a genetic class of masters, the first thing people think of is fascism. And they assume that this is just the fascist dystopia, but it's not. Eugenics isn't only a fascist thing. In fact, it originated in the constitutional monarchy of England and was very popular in the USA because of American progressives. But most importantly, fascism is not ruled by the warrior class. They just militarize all of society, especially the lower classes, who are indoctrinated into becoming soldiers for the ruling bureaucratic class, who are propped up by an ideological priest class ranting about duty to the people. Ich nach Leben! And these are the two classes that rule a fascist society. They might have a similar military mindset to a warrior class dystopia, but only to turn the commoners into cannon fodder. While warrior class rule often forbids the commoners from full-on military service and training of weapons, the warrior class does not rule fascist society, as evidenced by Italy, where the Italian king and his warrior aristocrats, like Baron Amadeo Ghiglie, who was a total badass, turned on the fascists and fought them in a literal civil war, and then the fascists went full bureaucratic rule with Mussolini founding the Italian Social Republic. But the dystopian golds in Red Rising are definitely space Germans with their blonde hair, sword duels, and facial scars. But they're more akin to one of the last great warrior class societies of the modern era, which is the German Empire of Kaiser Wilhelm II, who hated Mustache Man. Pretty much all the warrior aristocrats did, which is why they tried killing him in that Tom Cruise movie. Yes, Colonel Stauffenberg, who almost unalived the Austrian painter, was a noble. That famous bunker scene that became a meme is actually Mustache Man ranting about how the German generals, who were the warrior class, and Mustache Man vents on how he should have annihilated them like Stalin. Mustache Man also basically did ban the warrior class after Kaiser Wilhelm's grandson died fighting for Germany in France and garnered so much sympathy from around 50,000 Germans who mourned at his funeral, and that scared the crap out of Mustache Man, who realized that young warrior princelings were a threat to the German Workers' Party, so he enacted the so-called Prinzenerlass, or Prince's Decree, that banned members from Germany's former ruling houses from serving in combat roles precisely so that they didn't gain support from the public, who couldn't help but admire them as noble warriors. What a total asshole. Bureaucratic rule tends to create one totalitarian party or faction that controls everything, while warrior societies are actually not totalitarian because they divide themselves into different houses and factions that compete among themselves. Warrior class societies are authoritarian because they exclude the commoners from power, but not totalitarian because no one has total control. The Golds in Red Rising also operate via competing ruling houses that duel and kill each other in institutionalized death games and ritualistically put facial scars on themselves with swords, similar to the way the German aristocracy used to do. Which indicates that despite their terrible oppressive nature, the Golds from Red Rising and the nobles from Dune are the most appealing to human psychology than any of the other dystopian elites in this genre.
Land is nothing but dirt, after all. Correct. We're Britannian noblemen now. That's what counts.
And what about the common people you swore to protect?
Zero, when you walk down the street, do you worry about stepping on the ants?
Noblemen, you're bureaucrats. Paper pushers who know nothing about noblesse oblige.
Nations aren't dirt, and they're not systems. Their people.
It's easy to despise the parasitic capital technocrats in Hunger Games. It's easy to be repulsed by the Insoc Party and their claustrophobic system, or to feel contempt for the hedonistic alphas in Brave New World, who sacrifice human achievement for comfort and pleasure. But it's almost impossible not to admire or even love at least some of the brutal golds in Red Rising, or the noble leaders like the Atreides family in Dune. And that's part of what makes them so dangerous. And it's not only because they tend to be beautiful and sophisticated, but because they subject themselves to the same brutality and violence that they subject everyone else to. The nobles in Dune fight their own battles and put themselves in danger doing so, not to mention the back-breaking training that they go through from birth. And the golds in Red Rising are thrown into the wilderness as teenagers to simulate civilization, where these golden children fight and enslave each other and go through the hardships that they're expected to inflict on the rest of society once they get older. They personally sacrifice and bleed a lot to gain their power and gain the title of Peerless Scarred, so it's impossible not to think that they earned it, because in a way, they kind of in fact did earn their power. This is why so many people admire the Spartans and Romans, despite them being so tyrannical against their slaves, because young Spartan and Roman elites did earn their laurels through skill and sacrifice. Especially the Spartans, who were beaten and intentionally starved at 6 years old in the Agoge. It's hard not to be impressed. But in the end, the warrior class dehumanizes others through violence, and they dehumanize themselves through violence first. It's the cycle of violence, Madahaga! But this makes them much more appealing than the pampered, cushioned bureaucrats in the Hunger Games getting off of child violence from the luxurious comfort of their screens. Nobody really admires those pricks. But this natural psychological human inclination to respect personal sacrifice and those who lead by example is often used to justify the inhumanity of the warrior class dystopia, both to the warrior class elites themselves and to others. Especially the middle classes of those societies who tend to live the most comfortable lives in this type of society. It's the slaves and the elites who suffer the most violence, and the people in the middle are mostly fine, so it's them who end up admiring and supporting their badass warrior elites, who go like, oh wow, those guys are tough, I couldn't go like do that, I just do my desk job. But Lord Augustus Bellona or whatever, that guy, he could kill a lion with his bare hands, he's so awesome. This is why Piers Brown, the author of Red Rising, uses Lucifer as the perfect metaphor for the golds. Precisely because they're this seductive and superficially beautiful force of evil. It's also why the warrior slaves tend to rise up the most, like Spartacus in Rome, and the Mamluks in Egypt, or the Janissaries who didn't really rise up, but they ended up taking over the Ottoman Empire anyway, because their hardships makes them tough enough to challenge the ruling warriors, which is exactly what happens in Red Rising. But this is also why the warrior class is the least dystopian of the ruling classes, because they die in their own violence, and if they are not careful, they can easily exterminate themselves in modern industrial scale warfare, which is what happened in real history. Which is one of the main reasons why I kind of like rule of the warrior class. If you're gonna be ruled over by a tyrant, might as well be ruled over by a tyrant who might get himself killed, eh? Eh? You gotta be smart about this kind of thing. That bureaucrat in his office that rules over you in a bureaucratic dystopia, that guy's never gonna die. He's gonna sit in his air-conditioned office space until all of the rest of you die of scurvy or some shit. Why is there no real modern warrior class society in our era that isn't an African failed state? Warrior class societies used to be the majority of societies, now they barely exist. Why? Because they killed each other off in World War I. There was plenty of warrior kings in that war, like the King of Belgium and the blessed Kaiser Karl, who fought in the trenches, as well as Russian and German aristocrats. But they all bled each other to the death in European soil, leaving a power vacuum for despicable bureaucrats like Woodrow Wilson and the communists and fascists to take over. World War II later killed off what was left. Nowadays, the only warrior class society that exists as a modern state would maybe, arguably, kind of be Israel and Jordan. But that's pushing it, and no one else comes close to qualifying that I know of. Though the Russians are run by bureaucrats who LARP as feudal lords, who pretend to be tough guys, while their kids party in Paris and Dubai, which is despicable in itself. Anyway, modern warfare makes the warrior class the weakest of the ruling classes, which naturally makes them less capable of full-on dystopian levels of control that we see in others, because firstly, they have to limit certain dehumanizing technologies to avoid being replaced, as we see with them limiting AI in Dune and Red Rising, which prevents the mechanizing inhumanity we see in other dystopias, which is the most dehumanizing of systems. And secondly,
I declare but letting jihad.
And secondly, because ruling warriors naturally have to share power. Since they rely on the expertise of other classes, they literally can't run everything by themselves. They need help because violence will only take you so far in a sophisticated society. You see this in Dune, where the nobles share power with the non-warrior institutions like the priest class Bene Gesserit or the merchant class space navigators. We also see it in Red Rising with the four high colors like golds who are on top, but they need the silvers who are the financiers and businessmen, the whites who are clergy and judges, and coppers who are administrators, lawyers, and bureaucrats. Which means that Pierce Brown recognized the four main ruling social classes while writing his novels. He even made the merchants be the first agitators of the revolution, like in our history, which shows how he was really in tune with this kind of stuff. But even before modernity, the warrior class always had to share power with the ruling classes, naturally making them less centralized and less tyrannical than highly centralizing bureaucracies. Historically, warriors naturally shared power with the priest class, because spirituality helped them deal with fear and PTSD of war. But this naturally makes the warrior class among the most humble of the four ruling classes, because they know they can die at any moment, even if they're also the most brutal ruling class, inflicting their trauma on others. But something else that makes them the least dystopian ruling class is that warriors have the most in common with the working classes, because both go train themselves in tools and do dangerous and hard labor with their hands, while bureaucratic and merchant elites are often soft bebes that get way more on the working class nerves. You see this with Paul Atreides and the Fremen, and how he's able to adapt to their hard life despite being a privileged pretty boy because of how disciplined his lifestyle is. Now don't get me wrong, warriors are known to partake in the earthly pleasures of the flesh. That's why Eric Wesson, who is a military guy, wrote a series about a space chad and his space waifu harem. But the idea of nobles being privileged degenerate fat cats scourging on the labor of the people while doing nothing in return is only true when the noble family is in decline and they usually get replaced by tougher, more disciplined counterparts, which is exactly what happens when Atreides triumphs over the Harkonnens in Dune. Paul's victory over the Baron isn't really a happy ending in Dune, because his super awesomeness as a leader is precisely what makes him incredibly dangerous and gets billions of lives destroyed. He's actually worse than the Harkonnens in what he represents, because his personal virtues as a man makes him capture the imagination of his adoring followers. Paul, being the perfect prince, is precisely the dystopian problem in Frank Herbert's American "Don't tread on me, screw the government, F the police" mindset. In works of medieval chivalry, like the one written by Raymond Lowell, which I recommend you read, link in the description, he actually talks about how the ruling knights must appreciate and respect the other social classes, or, as he calls them, the social orders. Christian chivalry and spirituality in general is actually the best solution to make the warrior class less prone to dystopia, which we also see in Red Rising, where the more chivalric golds who believe in serving the weak instead of domination join the uprising from the lower classes, precisely because they admire chivalry and spirituality, as we see in this quote. "But when she sat before my hearth, as a girl beside Pax and my children, what stories did I read them? Did I read them myths of the Greeks, of strong men gaining glory for their own heads? No, I told them tales of Arthur, of the Nazarene, of Vishnu, strong heroes who wished only to protect the weak." Red Rising literally says that dystopian golds need Jesus, or Hinduism. I really enjoy that book series, YA silliness aside. But yes, chivalry was and is many things, but for Raymond Lowell, it was basically a political theory that justified warrior class rule over secular matters and dictates the proper spiritual and ethical path for the knight, precisely designed to avoid abuse of power. Blessed Raymond Lowell is the greatest thinker that most people have never heard of. He's the father of computational theory, by the way, basically inventing the computer in the Middle Ages, and was a former knight and scholar. In conclusion, dystopias are about the dehumanizing effect from the corrupt misuse of power. and how far it can go. The four main ruling classes of bureaucrats, merchants, priests, and warriors are connected to the four main types of power: the power of management and administration, the power of wealth and accumulating resources, the power of influencing what people believe, and the power of violence. All four forms of power are necessary for social coordination, prosperity, cohesion, and defense. Whether you like them or not, they are all necessary. People often ask me, what about the common class of workers and professionals, like doctors, scientists, truck drivers, people who work in factories, etc.? While the common working and professional classes of people are absolutely essential, they inherently don't have any power by themselves. If someone among them becomes powerful, it's usually by one of these four means. They either organized a union, but then the union guys are essentially bureaucrats, or they made something profitable and started a business, which makes them merchants, or they pushed an ideological or religious movement, which makes them priests, or they joined the military, or a violent revolution, which makes them warriors. Scientists and engineers are the same thing. They either invent something to sell, like big tech, they become technocratic experts for powerful organizations like the WHO, they use their scientific authority to push an ideology like positivism, or they become combat engineers and have a successful military career. Power by itself is not evil, and all these four types of power are valid and honorable when used correctly, even violence or influencing people's beliefs. We must be ready to defend ourselves, and society can't function if we disagree on fundamental principles. Not for long, anyway. The priest class gets maligned a lot in the modern era by the very academics who preach Enlightenment values and become the modern equivalent of the priest class, preaching the values that are in the interests of the bureaucratic class that runs the universities. But getting indoctrinated into the idea that indoctrination is wrong proves it's inevitable and even essential for social harmony, because we all need to believe in at least some essential common values. If some of us believe that slavery is a good thing, for instance, it's up to the priest class to convince them otherwise or condemn them as dangerous heretics to the human rights-based social order. Also, we need to remember that there is no utopia. We need to accept that. Utopia is the path to dystopia, because you have no clue what you're doing. Yes, we can improve things, but every solution we invent will cause its own problems that will require new solutions that will have their own problems to be solved until the end of time. The best we can do is improve ourselves as people and try to be there for one another. As one of my patrons reminded me, every man's utopia is another man's dystopia. There's some truth to that. I think understanding the four social classes the way our ancestors did can be helpful, because then we understand that when one complains about capitalism, they're actually just complaining about the merchant class that rose to power in the early modern period. All the written condemnations of capitalism is just criticism of merchant class pathologies and vices. But the managerial bureaucratic class has its own vices that are being more talked about now. But the good news is that all social classes, when working properly, hold each other in check and bring the best out of each other. The merchants solves problems and increases wealth, but can parasitically feed off of everything. The managers regulate but will tyrannize if they don't compromise. The priests will unite us in common cause but will divide us if they purity spiral. The warriors will defend us but will attack us if they seek to be unchallenged. Dystopias occur when there's an imbalance, as society becomes overwhelmed with a specific vice. The key to avoid dystopia is to find virtue within the balance of the golden mean, as Aristotle would say. It's about balance, not equality, and balance doesn't mean the exact equal amount of power for every class, but the right amount that each social class rightfully deserves. Like in an old-timey merchant scale, gold and silver are not the same weight, so you need different amounts of each to actually achieve a balance in the scale. This means the managerial bureaucracy should have a smaller share of the real political power than the other classes, since it naturally controls the most. I'm not saying bureaucrats are bad, but they absolutely should not be ruling society. They need to be lower in the hierarchy. You heard of Queen Anne's Revenge? Well, nowadays we're living in Secretary Anne's Revenge. Now I'll make them get me a cup of coffee. We all love secretaries, but if we get a general secretary, then we're all off to the gulag, you know what I'm saying? Enlightenment types and Marxists polluted the discourse with ideas of class warfare. That's why many assume that when I criticize a social class that I'm advocating for their annihilation, just as socialists want to annihilate the capitalist merchant class, or how Denis Diderot wanted to annihilate the priest class. But that's all stupid, and it's why modernity has this dystopian tendency. The pre-moderns were wiser in understanding that every class had its place, even if they could be oppressive about it. They still didn't promote extermination of part of the social order. I'm also critical of capitalism because I don't think the merchant class should have the ruling ideology. Neoliberalism will make you sell your mother for a quick cash. But I'm not against basic market dynamics and making money by selling stuff. I myself am technically a member of the merchant class. I make silly videos in exchange for your attention, and I make money from that. So when I promote books and video games to you guys, I'm not being a hypocrite, because I'm just advocating for moral limits on capitalism, not its total destruction. YouTubers who promote an end to capitalism can be so goofy sometimes.
If capitalism is allowed to survive, we will not. This episode is made possible by Henson Shaving. Give the AL-13 a try today. It's a great product, and it really does help support my channel.
But unlike in Marxism, this class theory I'm talking about that focuses on social roles and sees broad categories of people that fit into each particular role isn't meant to be an all-consuming theory of history to explain everything about human society. Unlike Marxism that literally thinks every social problem is explained by class struggle, and that's why nobody thinks fat women are attractive. That's a real thing, by the way. It's also not meant to divide everyone by arbitrary categories. Individual people usually can't be divided as merely warriors, merchants, bureaucrats, and priests. Look at Teddy Roosevelt. Which one was he? Was he a warrior of the Spanish-American War, a bureaucrat of the American government, or a merchant rancher? Most of history is populated by people like that, even in pre-modern times. They shift from one social role to another, and are often two or three or even four at the same time. Also, institutions often fulfill two or more roles as well. The Templars were warriors and priests and bankers. The Catholic Church is a massive bureaucracy of priests. In ancient Egypt, priests and bureaucrats were basically the same thing. In Tokugawa Japan, the samurai were mostly bureaucrats for all intents and purposes, unless they needed to harass a random grandmother for worshipping Jesus. But they still defined themselves as warriors and practiced the use of their warrior weapons extensively. So seeing these four social classes as categories is complicated and perhaps too limiting. But when you see them as somewhat abstract but very real social forces, that represents the four main forms of power, then they become very useful to understand some moments in history and also some current social problems. Even though they're not meant to explain every little phenomenon, these forces are still necessary to understand certain social phenomena that can't be explained otherwise. Like, why do woke companies keep losing money but persist in their wokeness? Isn't profit their incentive? Not really, because these corporations are so large that they're dominated by the managers who benefit more by adding diversity, equity, and inclusion and intersectional identity ideology stuff based on esoteric leftism rather than making profit. Because complicated human resources stuff increases their control over the company, even if it's at the expense of the company as a whole. And they can always get a job elsewhere if that company tanks. They don't own the company that they exert managerial power over, so they're incentivized to add more stuff for them to manage. You see? That's the secret. The merchants are nominally in charge of the company, but in reality they're ripped into line by the sheer mass of bureaucrats, and that's what happened to Bob Chapek at Disney, when he was forced to threaten company profits by getting political for no reason other than bureaucratic class interests. That's the face of a man held at gunpoint by some chick with blue hair just off camera. But in any case, dystopia is avoided by balance, and balance is virtue. How can we avoid dystopia? One of the great errors of the modern era was removing ethics from politics with Machiavelli, and then removing ethics from the economy with Adam Smith and Mandeville, and then removing ethics from war with the Prussian invention of total war, removing ethics from historical interpretation with Marxism. We need to relearn from medieval and classical scholars and reintroduce ethics into these things and take it seriously. Anyway, remember to tell me in the comments which type of dystopia you'd rather live in. Totalitarian boot? Corporate cyber slums? Shattery theocracy? Or new feudalism? For me, I'd pick cyberpunk dystopia because I like the music. And thank you for watching! You know, the best thing about being a YouTube content creator is meeting other creators, like the many game developers that approached me offering demo passes for me to play their games, recently in the last couple of days. Or the many writers with their own books that they've written. I couldn't accommodate them all, but I tried giving some a shout-out. No sponsorship, just one creator trying to help another. But it's getting impossible to keep up, so please don't feel discouraged if I don't have time to give your work a shout-out. It takes time to single each one out and try to, you know, give each one attention. So I think I'll just focus on making my own content for now. Also, this video was very difficult to do, and it took so long because I've been also working on a Webtoons series that we're about to launch in November. No Way I Art is just, it's a real human artist called Gabi, who's a friend of mine. It's called Fractal Fables. I'm really excited about it, and I hope you guys stay tuned. Don't worry, it's not about dystopia. It's more like reverse isekai, where a teenage girl realizes that her fictional characters are real in the multiverse and they invade our reality to save theirs because our collective unconscious is causing us doomsday event in their universes. Think of it as Gate meets Sophie's World meets the South Park Imagination Land episode.
Imagination.
Hope you guys like it. And a big, very warm thanks to my patrons. I would not be able to do this without you guys. Thank you all for listening to my ramblings. Have a good day, my friends.